Hello, and welcome back to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. I'm your host for this episode, Austin Benson. I am a PhD candidate in the English department here at the University of Virginia. I work on Early Middle English, Anglo-Norman, and Anglo-Latin literatures, and I moonlight in paleography, codicology, and textual editing. My dissertation, The Trilingual Book, Multilingualism, Manuscript Culture, and the Shaping of British Verse from the Eadwine Psalter to the Harley Lyrics, studies the development of insular poetry and the surviving trilingual manuscripts of post-conquest Britain. Interactions between languages is a subject near and dear to my heart, and is really essential for understanding multiculturalism in the Middle Ages. As we will soon discover together, you need look no further than medieval Britain to see its effects on full display. It is my privilege to study these interactions in the period's literary and manuscript cultures, and to introduce you to this vast and deeply interdisciplinary area of study. This episode, Multilingualism in Post-Conquest Britain, is about the languages people spoke in Britain in the centuries after it was conquered by the Normans in 1066. What languages were people speaking? In what contexts were these languages being spoken and written? How did these languages interact with each other? These are just a few of the questions we can start to think about in this episode. Now, the linguistic landscape of post-conquest Britain was incredibly diverse. In fact, at least 8 languages were being spoken in this period. English, Anglo-Norman, which is a dialect of Old French, Latin, Welsh, Cornish, Irish, Old Norse, and Hebrew. The field here is massive, even if you limit yourself, as I do, to literary studies, and no one person can realistically dream of grasping it all in their lifetime. This being the case, a significant portion of this episode is going to consist of interviews with scholars in some of these fields. While I will be leading the discussion of English, Anglo-Norman, and Latin, I will also be interviewing Dr. Sarah Pohn-Santh at Cardiff University about Old Norse, Dr. Georgia Henley at St. Anselm College about Middle Welsh, and Dr. Shama Boyarin at the University of Victoria about Hebrew. This lineup regrettably excludes Cornish and Irish, but this is a necessity in the interest of time. If anything, it should attest to the sheer scope of this field. While we can't even begin to really cover it all, by the end of this episode, you should have a much clearer understanding of the linguistic and cultural diversity of post-conquest Britain. Before we begin, however, I want to clearly define our terminology and discuss what exactly it means to study multilingual Britain. When I refer to Britain as being multilingual, I'm not just talking about the fact that multiple languages were being spoken there. I'm referring to the fact that these languages were interacting with each other. Speakers of different languages were communicating. Texts were being translated from one language to another. People were learning to speak more than one language. Languages were influencing each other, for example, by introducing new vocabulary. Language interaction can be a tricky subject to study. The best form of evidence in this field is oral evidence, and this, by definition, does not survive in the historical record. As medievalists, we have to do a clever bit of reconstruction. We have to look at what contemporaneous writers were saying about the languages spoken in the period. We have to rely on historical linguistics to see how languages were changing and influencing each other. We have to look at manuscripts and textual evidence to see whether languages were being written alongside of each other. These methods are imperfect, of course, but they're the best we have. And I hope you'll soon discover they are still extremely generative. To be clear, multiple languages had been spoken in Britain long before the conquest. Dr. Lindy Brady at Edgehill University has just published a really spectacular piece on this in the Cambridge Elements series called Multilingualism in Early Medieval Britain, and I highly recommend you give it a look if you want a more in-depth study of the pre-conquest situation. In his 8th century Ecclesiastical History of the English People, Bede wrote that there were 5 languages spoken in the region: English, British, Irish, Pictish, and Latin. I should clarify here that when Bede refers to a British language, he's referring to one of Britain's Celtic languages, which at this point had already begun to diverge into Old Welsh and Old Cornish. So, 2.5 centuries before the conquest, the linguistic landscape of Britain already saw a confluence of Celtic, Germanic, and Romance languages. This was exacerbated towards the end of the 8th century at the start of the Viking Age. In this period, groups of Scandinavians, that is people from what is modern-day Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, began to sail out and conduct raids along the coasts of the North Sea, especially in the British Isles. They eventually set up permanent settlements in the north of Britain, establishing their language, Old Norse, as a lasting and highly influential presence in the region. The influence of Old Norse reached its apex in 1016, when England was conquered by the Danish prince Canute, who ruled until his death in 1035. But exactly how prominent was Old Norse as a language in Britain, and how did it interact with the languages around it? For this, we're going to turn to our first interview with Dr. Sarah Pohn-Santh at the University of Cardiff. We are here with Dr. Sarah Pohn-Santh, reader in the School of English, Communication, and Philosophy at Cardiff University. And before we begin, Sarah, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you work on.
Yeah, thank you. So as people might guess from my accent and from my names, I'm Spanish. I did two degrees, one in English philology and another one in Spanish philology in Spain at home in Valencia. And then I was really fortunate to go to the University of Nottingham as part of an Erasmus exchange. And I loved it so much that I stayed there for 2 years. And that's really where my passion for Anglo-Scandinavian contact or the study of Old English, Middle English, Old Norse really flourished and developed. So when I finished my undergraduate degrees, I went back to Nottingham. And then from there, I went to Cambridge. And I did my master's and my PhD in Cambridge under the supervision of Richard Dance. And Richard is a specialist in the study of Norse derived terms in English. So I did my PhD on the Norse terms in the works of Archbishop Wulfstan II of York. And then after that, I was very fortunate to have a postdoc. And so I went back to Nottingham. And then from there, I went to the University of Westminster and now Cardiff. In terms of what my work focuses on is mainly the impact of the linguistic interaction between the speakers of Old English and the speakers of Old Norse on the vocabulary of medieval English. So my PhD focused on the Old English period, and that was also the focus of my postdoc. But more recently, I've become very interested, obviously, on the Middle English period, which is when we see most of the terms that came into the language, because we have texts that come from a wider variety of dialectal areas. So Richard and I led on a project funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council called the Gerson Project that focused on the identification of Norse-derived terms in English and the kinds of evidence that we have in order to establish some etymological decisions, because, of course, the two languages are quite close to one another. The study of Norse influence in English has also led me to consider not only etymology, but also stylistics, dialectology. I'm also interested in glosses. So I have done quite a bit of work, for instance, on the Lindisfarne glosses, as well as other kind of issues that might not seem so closely related, such as, for instance, speech representation in medieval texts. So a wide range of issues, but my core area of research, you could say where my heart really lies, is the contact between the speakers of Old English and speakers of Old Norse.
Thank you, Sarah. That's all really quite fascinating. So before we get into the weeds, so to speak, I think the best question to start with in these kinds of discussions is simply, who was speaking, reading, and writing Old Norse in medieval Britain, and in what contexts were they doing that?
As far as we know, not that many people were writing it. Some people carved it. There are a few runic inscriptions. Not that many. So when it comes to Old Norse in medieval Britain, we're talking mainly about the spoken language. So When people talk about the presence of Old Norse in England, we tend to think about three different phases. The first phase, we have hit and run attacks. So the attacks started at the end of the 8th century, and they continued until, say, the middle of the 9th century. So at that point, Britain was a bit of a summertime playing ground. So they came in the summer, they plundered, they did all kinds of activities, and then they went back home. And so that didn't really lend much to linguistic interaction. The proper context of the interaction between the speakers of Old English and Old Norse came as in connection with the settlement of the Scandinavian newcomers from the middle of the 9th century. And so they settled mainly to the north and to the east of an, if you think of an imaginary line between London and Chester, so the area known as the Danelaw. And so that would have led to a period of quite close interaction between the speakers of the two languages. We know that they lived as neighbors. In many cases, they would have been intermarried. And then we have finally a period of political domination with King Canute. So, with regard to who would have been speaking Old Norse, obviously we had different types of newcomers. In the first instance, we would have had the Vikings coming to Britain and attacking the shores and then going back home. Then we had settlers. We also had people that would have come, say, from the Irish Sea, that would have come occasionally to England and then gone back, or people that would have come from Scandinavia and then gone back. With King Canute, we know that there were a series of followers that would have come with him and that they would have settled in some areas outside the Danelaw. And so that might also help us explain the presence of some Norse loanwords in areas outside the initial area of settlement. We know that there might have been as well some schools, some poets that might have come to England. But yeah, most people would have been settlers, tradesmen, women as well. Women and children would have traveled with them. But yeah, we're talking mainly about spoken language rather than so much written and read language.
Sure. And of course, that's my own bias, as someone more interested in literary studies than in linguistics. So, as you've explained, spoken day-to-day contact would have been the main nexus of contact between Norse and English speakers. I am curious to know, however, if there are any texts, runic inscriptions, poetry, or otherwise, you mentioned poets coming in with Canute, that may have survived from the period.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in that area, but there are some inscriptions. For instance, there is one in London that says something like, you know, such and such was here kind of inscription. So it's not a very elaborate inscription. There are some inscriptions as well where we have some Scandinavian loanwords that are already included there. For instance, there is an inscription from Yorkshire from the 11th century where we have some Scandinavian words. In terms of the poems, there would have been some poets that came, for instance, to do some poetry to King Canute. There is a Canute's Drauper. So we know that there would have been some itinerant poets that came to England to kind of, you know, compose poetry in the favor of the king, and then they would have probably gone back home. But the texts that we have that are associated with Norse in England are very limited. What we have is mainly English texts that have some Scandinavian words in them.
I see. And from what you describe, it sounds like they would have been rather isolated culturally. I mean, English speakers wouldn't have been consuming the Knutsdrapa or other Norse texts.
Yeah, not necessarily. I think I mean there would have been some interaction. We think, for instance, that King Alfred might have also spoken to a traveler from Scandinavia, Ohtera, but those would have been quite isolated cases. The interaction would have happened mainly in terms of, you know, the settlers or people, say, in York or in Lincoln, where you had tradesmen.
Certainly. I'm curious then about the speakers of Old Norse who settled in England and made their homes there. Do we have any idea of the time frame in which they transitioned from speaking Old Norse and became English speakers?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So it's been suggested that by the 12th century, probably Old Norse would have disappeared as an everyday spoken language by a large group of people in England. But the key thing is to remember, of course, the sociolinguistic interactions between the speakers of Old English and the speakers of Old Norse would have varied across different areas. And so that language shift probably happened in different places at different times. So I mentioned earlier the glosses to the Lindisfarne Gospels. So the Lindisfarne Gospels received some glosses by Aldred, who was someone based in Northumbria, working very close to Durham at the middle of the 10th century. And there we already have not only technical words that come from Old Norse, or terms referring to social ranks, for instance, or money, but also some everyday words like bed, for instance, or daring. And so I think that what these terms suggest is that probably in the areas around Aldred's community, the community of St. Cuthbert, that language shift happened earlier because there were fewer Norse speakers in those areas than in areas like York or Lincoln, where there would have been more people. And so those people, I think, are likely to have shifted over to English. And when doing so, they would have brought with them some of their own words, a process known as imposition. So, yeah, I think that we shouldn't think of something that is a kind of a Unitarian principle, but rather different places exhibiting different types of relationships, and so the linguistic shift happening at different stages.
So do we see differences in the influence of Old Norse on differing dialects of Middle English then?
Yeah, so we see already a very clear difference during the Old English period. And what we see is that, of course, as we know, most of the texts were written in the West Saxon speaking area or areas under West Saxon influence. And so in those areas, what we have are mainly terms that are associated with cultural practices of the Scandinavians. So referring to navigation, to social ranks, to monetary units of account, etc. Whereas in the areas where the Scandinavians settle down, we start to see terms that refer to everyday practices, as I was saying in the Aldridean glosses. The problem that we have, of course, is that we have very few texts from those areas during the Old English period. And so by the time we go to the Middle English period, we start to see more and more of the actual impact of Norse. So for instance, when we look at a text like the Ormulum from around 1180 South Lincolnshire, probably, we see a really heavy presence of Scandinavian words because this text would have been composed right at the heart of the Scandinavian presence in a way that, for instance, Lahamundsbrot doesn't exhibit. We have much fewer words from Old Norse. So during the Middle English period, we really start to appreciate the full impact of the results of the Anglo-Scandinavian contact. And we have some words that are very widespread. And so we find them in all dialects, whether they are from the Danelaw or outside the Danelaw. And then we also have some words that are very characteristic of the Scandinavianized areas. A word like ill, for instance, is a word that during the Middle English period still has a very close association with the Scandinavianized areas. And for instance, Chaucer only uses it in rhyming position. And the only context where he doesn't use it in rhyming position is in the speech of the Northern scholars in the Rivesdale. So that suggests that for him, ill was still a very kind of Northern dialectally marked form.
That's fascinating. It's really interesting to see the different terms that enter the lexicon depending on the contexts in which Old Norse actually came into contact with English. I'd also like to ask about the Norman conquest and the imposition of Anglo-Norman as the language of governance and the prestige vernacular in England. What influence, if any, might this have had on Old Norse in Britain? Keeping in mind that, from what you've said, it seems like it was, at this point, already in decline.
Yes, I know. I guess, well, Harald had rather tried to conquer England and didn't succeed. So, had he succeeded, then obviously Norse would have been spoken for longer, I guess. So, with the arrival of the Normans, what we had is, of course, a ruling class who spoke a different language. And so, we have a change in the sociolinguistic situation of medieval Britain. And so, I guess, in that respect, the fate of English and Norse goes hand in hand, in that English and some Norse words were being used to refer to government and in other areas of life. But then, of course, with the arrival of the Normans, we see that new terms are being used. So, one of the clearest areas of impact is, for instance, the legal world, where there would have been some Norse and English words that were used to refer to specific concepts. And then we have French words kind of taking over. Although, interestingly, the word law, Old English lagu, is from Old Norse. So, you know, the Vikings have this really bad reputation about being an unruly bunch of people, but actually, the word law is from Old Norse. So, yeah, I guess it certainly had an impact on the continuous arrival of people from Scandinavia, but also what happened to the words that were already in the English language that were being used to refer to specific concepts.
I think that's so interesting that Old Norse remained, for the most part, a spoken language, and that we have to reconstruct its status in medieval Britain through loanwords, dialectical developments, and these other historical linguistic methods. One final question to wrap things up. If somebody were interested in learning more about Old Norse and medieval Britain, where would you recommend they go?
So I guess that for a very gentle introduction, one could start with any history of the English language, where, of course, there is always a section on language contact. And so Old Norse is discussed together with, say, Latin or French. They might want to have a look at Matthew Townend's chapter in the History of English volume edited by Linda Mugglestone, where he talks about precisely that kind of early situation of language contact, where Norse is discussed with French and Latin, and he does a fantastic job. Matthew Townend, Matt also published a book which was based on his dissertation on the issue of mutual intelligibility between the speakers of Old English and Old Norse. And it's a really interesting book. It was published in 2002 by Breppels, so they might want to have a look at that. For a bit more advanced, they might want to consider a volume that Richard Dance published in 2003, again based on his PhD on the presence of Norse-derived terms in early Middle English texts from the Southwest Midlands. They might want to have a look at my book on the lexical effects of Anglo-Scandinavian contact in Old English. But that's a little bit more advanced, so maybe not so much for the faint-hearted. Yeah, I think a gentle way to get started would be having a look at the history of English and Matthew Townend's work.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, Sarah. It's been really wonderful to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to talk about the Norman Conquest. Unfortunately, we don't have time in this episode to unpack the details of the dynastic dispute that led Duke William of Normandy to press a claim on the English throne and invade. Suffice it to say that when King Edward the Confessor died childless in 1066, there was a scramble to seize the English throne. And although the Earl of Wessex, Harold Godwinson, was crowned shortly thereafter, he was soon killed by the Normans in the Battle of Hastings, and William was crowned King of England on Christmas Day that year. The social, political, and cultural ramifications of the Norman Conquest were so vast that honestly, you could have an entire podcast on the subject, let alone a segment in a single episode. What's important to know for now is this. In the decades after the conquest, William systematically replaced almost all of the English earls, bishops, and abbots of England with his followers from Normandy. This didn't go unopposed, of course, but the opposition was unsuccessful. By the turn of the 12th century, then, the first language of much of the upper ranks of the political and ecclesiastical hierarchies was Anglo-Norman. Indeed, Anglo-Norman assumed a position alongside Latin as a documentary, an administrative language. As a result of all this, anyone of any political or ecclesiastical ambition, especially if they were a native English speaker, had to acquire at least oral competence in Anglo-Norman, alongside the usual familiarity with Latin that such aspirations entailed. Bilingualism was extremely common in these circles, and trilingualism was not rare. Fortune is always turning her wheel, of course, and this was no less the case for the Anglo-Norman language. The Norman aristocracy assimilated with the English rather quickly over the course of the 12th century, such that by the turn of the 13th century, English was their first language, and Anglo-Norman their second. The language was still standard for daily communication, especially in the courts, and it maintained its status as a documentary and administrative language, but it was no longer a mother tongue, so to speak. The spoken language follows this trend over the next few centuries, becoming increasingly isolated to legal, judicial, and other administrative contexts, and otherwise being replaced by English. What about English, then? Before the conquest, the West Saxon dialect of Old English was the language of government and administration, and was also, of course, the first language of the English. After the Norman conquest, while it lost the former function and suffered a severe blow to its social prestige, it was, nevertheless, the mother tongue of almost everyone in England, and later in Britain. There are two threads, then, in the story of English in the centuries following the conquest. The first involves its slow ascent back to a place of social and literary prestige, and the second involves the massive lexical and structural changes it underwent. I'd like to focus on the latter here. Because of the relative ubiquity of Anglo-Norman in the cultural centers of post-conquest Britain, and because so many people in these centers were bilingual or trilingual, Anglo-Norman exerted a great deal of influence on the English language, especially on its lexicon. English took thousands of loanwords from Anglo-Norman. We can see this in social contexts with words like baron, noble, servant, or feast, in legal contexts with words like justice, judge, estate, or attorney, and in literary contexts with words like story, rhyme, or lay. So, while the Anglo-Norman language itself eventually faded from use, it had an enormous impact on the development of English as we speak it today. Anglo-Norman wasn't the only language that crossed over the Channel after the Norman conquest, however. Among those that came to Britain were Jewish communities from France, and while French was their first language, they brought their liturgical language of Hebrew along with them. With that in mind, let's turn to our second interview with Dr. Shama Boyarin at the University of Victoria. Shama, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Austin. I'm always glad to talk about Anglo-Jewish medieval literature. It's a topic that is, I think, more people need to hear about. So this is a great opportunity for me.
Of course. And we're thrilled to give you this opportunity. So before we begin, can you tell us about yourself and your work?
Yeah, so my training really, my PhD was in comparative literature, and I worked on medieval Hebrew and Arabic literature, mostly from medieval Spain. And in doing that work, you know, a lot of the people who were in my program who did modern comparative literature were looking at maybe neighboring nations, but languages that were not overlapping. So let's say French and German, or Spanish and English, and things like that. And as I was doing my work on medieval Hebrew and Arabic literature, there's so much overlap because the Jews in Spain were speaking Arabic and thinking Arabic and were really modeling a lot of their Hebrew literature on Arabic literature. And I wanted to kind of get a bit of away from that and to think about kind of an extreme test case. So I started looking at literature from England, medieval England, and thinking kind of as Jews as being very not present in medieval England. So already at that stage, I was already kind of peeking at what happens in England in terms of literature and in terms of Jewish presence and all of that. But I wasn't really looking at Jewish literature from medieval England. And then when I came to the University of Victoria, for complicated reasons, I kind of landed in the English department here and ended up thinking a lot more about how my interest in medieval Jewish literature related to the history of English literature. And as this podcast attests, it's a really interesting time for thinking about English literature generally and medieval English literature generally, where people were already asking what were the other languages in England, in the island that influenced English literature, right? People already for a long time thought of French as being part of the history of English. But what does that mean for English literature as a kind of tradition where French is always there, and then Latin is there, and then thinking about things like Old Norse and all kinds of complicated things, right? So in this conversation, and I'm not the only one, but I'm part of those voices of people who are thinking, okay, but what about other languages that might not directly impact English literature the same way that, let's say, French did, but were there as part of the literary tradition? And that's where my work on kind of Jewish literature and Hebrew literature comes into this picture.
That's really splendid, and I think that perspective is so important. So, the first question we need to ask to understand Hebrew literature from medieval Britain is who exactly was speaking or reading Hebrew in medieval Britain, and in what contexts?
Okay, that's a great question. And let me kind of throw in some history in part of it to kind of give some of that. So, to the best of our knowledge, Jews come into medieval England with the conquest, with William the Conqueror. So they come at a very specific moment of transition. That is, we don't know that there are no Jews before, but we have no evidence for Jewish presence in England before that. So they really come in this major transformative historical cultural moment for England. French comes in with the conquest, and Jews are part of that import, if you will. And they're brought in very much to serve as part of the economic apparatus that William the Conqueror and then the Normans in England develop. As you may know, Jews in the Middle Ages in many Christian countries served in part as moneylenders, as part of the kind of banking system. And so this was very much the case for Jews in England, and you'll see why this relates to Hebrew. So a lot of the Jewish activity in England is around money lending and economic activity. And so a lot of the Hebrew that we have from this period in England is related to that. A lot of legal documents that are alongside the Latin and French and English documents pertaining to the economic activities of England are also in Hebrew, kind of from the Jewish perspective, where Jews kind of add their own glosses and their own testimonies to whatever the document is. So, in some ways, the vast majority of Hebrew that is produced in medieval England is not literary. It's is legalese, if you will. And the vast majority of Hebrew that people in England are seeing at the time, Jews and non-Jews, well, I would say more Jews and more non-Jews than Jews, pertains to these legal documents. But Jews still use Hebrew for their own purposes. And so we see Jews writing Hebrew texts that are linguistics. We see Jews writing liturgical texts and texts that pertain to their religious observances. And we see a small amount of poetry, belles-lettres, you know, so like not novels, but parables and various other kinds of stories produced by Jews in England in Hebrew.
I'm really interested in the idea of Hebrew functioning simultaneously as a literary language and a language of record. But what you said specifically about the literary output I thought was very interesting. Could you give us an overview of the literature that was being written in Hebrew in this period? And how would you place it in the wider context of Jewish diaspora literatures in medieval Europe?
So one thing to keep in mind, and maybe kind of as a second answer, I'll get to some of the reasons for this. We have very little surviving literature of Jews from England. Certainly, you know, as somebody who's moving from having worked on the Jews of medieval Spain, for example, it's minuscule. We have some poetry, most of it in the form of religious poetry, so poetry written to be used as part of synagogue ritual. We have some adaptation, translation of fables, you know. So, if you know, like the Aesopic fable tradition, And if you know, if you're working, you know, in thinking about the Aesopic fable tradition in the context of England, there's the famous collection of fables that Marie de France produced in French, but in England. So there's a parallel to that kind of collection of fables stemming from this Aesopic tradition in Hebrew and some interesting poetry. There's a short poem that somebody found, four lines, that is attributed to a guy named Menachem of Saltwharf, which is a neighborhood in London. It's a four-line poem that's kind of a debate between the different parts of a candle, the wick and the tallow, right? The wax of the candle, about which part of the candle is the most important for producing light. So, you know, so not a lot, but very interesting stuff that survives.
And would you say that's reflective of what we see elsewhere in medieval Europe, as far as the literary output from other Jewish populations goes?
So, in terms of the quality of it, I would say yes, although only recently have people started to kind of really appreciate that aspect of it. That is, that it's good poetry and good writing. The question of what makes something good is a whole, you know, we could have hours long conversations about aesthetics, right? But in terms of the amount of it, it's very little. Scholars, both from the kind of who've approached it from the side of Jewish studies, and let's say more broader medievalists who've looked at kind of medieval history, have kind of used the example of the Jews of England, of medieval England, as kind of the epitome of the non-intellectually productive community. So, as I said, they come into England with William the Conqueror, and they are in England until they're expelled from England in the late 13th century. So they're in England for roughly 200 years, which is, in some sense, a long time, but in terms of being an established Jewish community in England, in a place, it's not very long. And what most scholars have said is that because of that, and because they've come from France, they don't develop their own discrete intellectual history. And so, by and large, whatever literary production that we've had from them has been dismissed as being minor and not important. I have been one of, and I want to stress that I'm not the only one, who has been pushing to reassess this. And from a number of different angles, people have been pushing against this assessment of the Jews of England as not being very intellectually creative. And we have evidence that perhaps, you know, first of all, as I said, they were expelled in 1291. And so it is natural to assume that with the expulsion, some things might have not survived, some things might have been lost. And in fact, we have accounts written by non-Jews, Christians, talking about the expulsion and saying that there were boats laden with Jewish possessions, including books, that sunk off the English shore. So who knows what was on those boats in terms of Jewish literature produced in England? And there's other reasons to suspect that perhaps the reason there's not that much is it just didn't survive. They didn't take it with them. It wasn't copied by other Jews elsewhere. And as I said, the quality of what does survive suggests a very interesting, intellectually, to use a metaphor, intellectually mature community that is creating unique literary texts. Again, there's not a lot of it, so it's hard to speak of a school of English medieval poets. Jewish poets from medieval England, but the examples that we have are really sophisticated and interesting and unique in various ways. They show that they are reading medieval poetry, Hebrew poetry written by Jews from Spain as well as from France, and engaging with it and adapting it for their own personal use.
Wonderful. My next question would be, in what contexts would the Jewish population of medieval England have come into contact with the other languages of the period? And I'm referring to the vernaculars, English, Anglo-Norman, Middle Welsh, but also to Latin.
Yeah, so French was their vernacular. They were speaking French. We know this both in terms of the evidence of the Jewish community that they come from France, but also in terms of how they're functioning in England, at least in the first generations that they're there, right? They're part of, as I said, this economic system that by and large functions at least spoken in French with Latin as part of the kind of documentary evidence. We see that they refer to place names in England in the French terminology. They refer to England as Inglaterra in their writing, even hundreds of years, you know, kind of towards the end of their time there. So French is certainly part of their spoken language. When we talk about, for example, the fables that I mentioned, the collection of fables that is by a man named Brahe Hanakdan, and those seem to have been, he doesn't tell us, but they seem to have been translated from French into Hebrew. So he's certainly reading French and translating it into Hebrew. We see translations of texts written by English scholars in Latin being translated into Hebrew. So, so there's definitely strong evidence for encountering not just spoken, but written French and Latin as part of their literary contacts. It's a little bit harder to pinpoint English. There's an argument that's being made very convincingly that they began to speak English as part of their vernacular interactions with their neighbors, their Christian neighbors. But whether they're, reading, part of what is difficult is the period of the expulsion of the Jews from England also coincides with the shift in the value of literary production in Middle English, right? So even though English never falls out of use as a written text, even under the Normans, it's still a lesser, by and large, valued medium for writing and reading. When English literature really starts to become more important in England is exactly at the same time that the Jews are expelled, right? So there's a complicated issue there in terms of would Jews read English texts and literary texts. Again, going back to the documentary element of it, right? Just as Jews are producing legal texts in Hebrew, they're using legal texts in Latin and French, right? So it's a complex question. One of my hopes is that as we engage with this question more and kind of look at what they produce, and more scholars start to cross over, not just people like me who are trained in Hebrew, but people who are trained in Latin literature and in Middle English literature start engaging with these Hebrew texts, that we can start having more interesting conversations about the literary shared literary tradition.
That's a great point you bring up about the problem of timing with the rise of Middle English as a literary vernacular, and also, of course, the expulsion of the Jews. So, my final question was going to be whether we see any evidence of this contact in the surviving literature, but of course, you've kind of answered that question for me. It seems like translation, as is often the case in these multilingual cultures, is the main nexus for linguistic exchange. My knowledge of it goes no further than manuscripts of Christian Hebraists who would experiment with writing Hebrew.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to add, is that while we have no evidence of Christians reading kind of the poetry and literature that I'm talking about, there certainly is a interest among Christian English scholars in Hebrew, for purposes of understanding Bible and so on and so forth. So they are engaging with Hebrew beyond the documentary stuff that I mentioned earlier on. And so I think there is potential, at least, for them to be reading the liturgical poetry and to be thinking about it. We have no evidence of it, but again, as is the case with a lot of these things, the more people engage, the more of us, that is scholars of literature, that engage with these things, the more I think there's potential for thinking and finding more interesting ways to kind of think about the linkages between literature. And that's the point of doing this stuff, of the kind of multicultural Middle Ages, is to kind of come up with novel approaches to culture and to contact.
Well, in my completely unbiased opinion, you've made a very spectacular case for that. I'd like to close this out by asking, if someone were interested in learning more about Anglo-Jewish literature and culture in the Middle Ages, where would you recommend they start?
So Ruth Nissa has written a book called Jacob's Shipwreck. It came out, I think, in 2017 or 2018. And it touches on some of the literature that I've mentioned and really kind of tries to think about how Jews and Christians in England used literature and historical writing and biblical commentary and extra biblical commentary to navigate a kind of different ideas of belonging and connection. So that's one place that I would start. I would also say that there's a lot of interesting work on the representation of Jews in Christian literature. And in terms from the Jewish perspective, I think we're still at the beginning of trying to kind of trace this history in a way that is accessible to people who are in the field. So unfortunately, I can't quite point yet to anything that's out there that I think, but I'm working on translation. Hopefully that will come out of some of this poetry and literature, and to give it some more of a context. But I think definitely starting with Ruth Nissa's book is a great place.
Wonderful. And we really look forward to your translations and editorial work in the future. And thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
So Hebrew was an extremely generative language in the documentary and, we have learned, literary cultures of multilingual Britain. And although we can't treat it as our only source of evidence, literary culture is a very important place for us to look if we want to better understand multilingualism in this period, especially since so many of the texts that survive from this period are translations out of other languages. This is a subject that I could discuss for ages, but in the interest of time, I rather want to push us to think as well about the intersection of the literary and the material in our exploration of multilingual Britain. Two material artifacts that help us better understand the relationship between English, Anglo-Norman, and Latin, for example, are two trilingual manuscripts from the late 13th and early 14th centuries. These are Oxford Bodleian Library, MS Digby 86, and London British Library, MS Harley 2253. Not only are both of these manuscripts trilingual, but they are also our primary sources for a really significant portion of the surviving Middle English and Anglo-Norman lyrics. Multilingual manuscripts like these were really fertile ground for the development of English literature in this period. One thing, curiously, that these manuscripts also have in common is that they were produced near or in the Welsh Marches. This swath of counties bordering Wales is probably second only to London in the quality of texts we can attribute to it. The poet of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and Pearl, for example, most likely hailed from Cheshire. What role did Wales and the Welsh play in multilingual Britain, and where do we see their influences? To answer this, let's turn to our final interview with Dr. Georgia Henley at St. Anselm College. We are here today with Dr. Georgia Henley, Assistant Professor of English at St. Anselm College. Why don't we start off, Georgia, by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Yeah, I am currently working on a book called Reimagining the Past in the Borderlands of Medieval England and Wales, and it's kind of an interdisciplinary look at how ideas of the Welsh past were used by marcher families in the gentry and aristocracy to solidify their position in the border region between Wales and England. They kind of rewrote and incorporated Welsh history and genealogy into their own family histories as part of their kind of program of solidifying their position in that region as they were taking over. And I've also done some work on Geoffrey of Monmouth, on Gerald of Wales, and on Welsh historical writing. So that's my background.
That's really exciting. Thank you. Let's start off with fundamentals. Can you tell me a little bit about who was speaking, reading, and writing Middle Welsh in this period, and the contexts in which they were doing it?
Yeah, so Middle Welsh, which is the version of Welsh that was spoken in the medieval period, I think we're saying 1100 to 1400. There's Old Welsh before that as well. Middle Welsh was both a literary language that survives in written text, but also a language of everyday use. So people at all levels of society in Wales and the March of Wales would have been speaking Welsh, from the common people to the merchant classes, all the way through to the gentry and the royalty. I should also note that Wales, as like a political entity, refers to the Principality of Wales, but also typically when in scholarship we're talking about Wales, we're talking about the bounds of modern day Wales, even though in the medieval period, some of that region was actually encompassed within the March of Wales, particularly a lot of parts of South Wales were the marches. So it's a little bit iffy to just say like, this is Wales and this is everywhere else because those boundaries were changing a lot. And then also, so people were speaking Welsh within that region that we call Wales, but also in the March, the name for the borderlands between Wales and England. And then also elsewhere, because people, Welsh speaking people traveled. So there were communities of Welsh speakers outside of Wales as well, particularly in London, late medieval London and Oxford had Welsh-speaking communities.
Spectacular. And could you give us a quick overview of the sorts of literature that was being produced in Middle Welsh in this period?
Yeah, comparable to other countries in medieval Europe, you have a full range of genres. And even the way that we think of genre is slightly different, but we could say that they had history writing, they had religious literature, hagiography, prophecy, prophetic poetry, lots of genealogy, the triads, which are unique in a Celtic context, sort of traditional lore and information that's written in threes. So it's easier, it's sort of like a product of memorization. There was a lot of poetry that was written, lyric poetry, love poetry, religious poetry, and then of course, bardic poetry produced by a class of professional poets who worked for the nobility, and they would they were commissioned to write panegyric and eulogy and elegy. That's poetic tradition that is particular to Celtic language speaking societies. And then there's also prose literature, that famously the four branches of the Mabinogi are probably the most well-known prose literary works from medieval Wales. But there's also a wide range of romances. There's medical texts, scientific texts, law. There's a big law tradition, and then also grammar that goes along with the bardic poets who sort of wrote grammars of the language in the late medieval period. In terms of a comparison with other vernacular traditions of medieval Europe, that's kind of, you know, a dissertation topic's worth of discussion. But as elsewhere in medieval Britain, you could say that the backbone of written literature, of literary culture in Wales was Latin, right? People had education in Latin, the religious tradition was in Latin. So the influence of Latin religious literature and also classical literature is quite pervasive in written literature in Wales. There's somewhat of a misconception that Latin was brought to Wales by the Anglo-Norman colonizers, but there's a long-standing tradition of Latin writing in Wales long before that. There's not as much Middle Welsh or Welsh literature surviving from the early medieval period. There's Old Welsh that survives in the form of mostly glosses and a few like marginal notes. If you're comparing Welsh literature to English literature in the medieval period, there's just, you know, there's not as much from the early period like there is with Old English. The bulk of surviving Middle Welsh literature is from a little bit from the 13th century, but mostly 14th and 15th centuries. So most of it lands in that late medieval period. So it's kind of more contemporary with Scots and with Middle English than Old English. Middle Welsh literature is very much influenced by the tastes and the trends of French literature and culture. The people who were commissioning and producing Middle Welsh literature were very interested in French romance. And it sort of had, as a language of the elites of Britain, right, the French had kind of perceived fashion. It was like fashionable, right, and interesting. And the other thing I wanted to say was what I had mentioned about the bardic tradition, that that's something that is quite different, I think, from Middle English literature, literature of medieval England, is this very strong bardic order of professional poets, which is comparable to what's happening in Ireland and Scotland.
Great. I know that was a huge question, so thank you. I'm interested in what you mentioned about French and Anglo-Norman literatures being influential on Middle Welsh, specifically with the genres that they're interested in. Could you speak a little bit more about that? And I might also ask whether anything comparable happens with Middle English.
Yeah, so with French literature in Wales, there's a number of translations of French literature into Middle Welsh for late medieval lay patrons of the nobility. Some of the romances of Cotin de Troyes in the 14th and 15th century are translated into Welsh. So there's three Middle Welsh romances that correspond to Chrétien's Yvain, Eric and Enid, and Percival. They're not direct translations. They're kind of more like adaptations, which is, of course, very typical of medieval translation practice. Like they're sort of changing it as they go along. And so there's been a lot of work done on why those changes were made and sort of how they reflect Welsh culture, you know, like a cultural translation, right? The Charlemagne cycle was also translated into Welsh, translated from the Chanson de Roland, a couple of other Charlemagne romances as well. The Grail cycle is translated into Welsh. Bevis of Hampton is translated into Welsh. There's a bestiary. There's a bunch of different texts that are translated into Middle Welsh from French, and the most of them are from South Wales, where there was kind of like an seemed to have been some members of the gentry there who were particularly interested in that type of literature. There's also a strong documentary culture in French in Wales, because of course, if the aristocracy is French speaking in England and in the March of Wales and in Wales, that's kind of the language of communication between those different countries. So there's letters to and from English administrators or nobility, mostly in matters of state and diplomacy and things. There's also some record of translators who worked between like the different members of the nobility that needed to communicate for political reasons or for, you know, reasons of intermarriage. So there's examples of different Welsh people who acted as go-betweens between like the Welsh princes and the English kings, for example. So that would suggest that the Welsh princes were not necessarily comfortable speaking French, like they needed a translator, but in some cases they probably did speak French as a language of communication. There's also a lot of examples of French speakers Thomas Cantilupe was the Bishop of Hereford who was up for canonization. And so there's all these records from a legal court of the canonization proceedings that show that people in the town of Conwy in North Wales, just sort of ordinary people like cooks and servants and things, could speak French. So that's a solid example. And one can also imagine the French language being spoken in monasteries in Wales, because the continental orders, particularly the Cistercians, were very strong in Wales. And so there are people, you know, coming straight over from France to work in those monasteries, and they would have spoken French as well. You also asked about English. So there's an influx of English speakers into Wales during the conquest period and afterwards. So English is thought to be the language of like the towns that are founded by colonists or settlers or whatever you want to call them. So one can imagine contact between Welsh speakers and English speakers among the local population and in monasteries and there's some evidence of written literature in English that's from Wales. I think there's a copy of the Middle English Prose Brut that's from Denby. But it sort of struck me when I was thinking about this discussion ahead of time that while French is pretty well studied, French in Wales is sort of something that Celticists talk about. English in Wales is not really, it's sort of like fallen through the cracks because it's a majority language and people studying a minority language don't really want to, you know, give it a lot of airtime. And then people who study English are not necessarily looking at Wales. So it's something that isn't as well studied as it could be. And I'm afraid that I'm overlooking something important, but I don't know as much about English in Wales as French in Wales.
That's perfectly fine. Just pointing to a potential gap in the scholarship is valuable in and of itself. And speaking of scholarship, if someone were interested in learning more about Middle Welsh, either learning the language or being introduced to its literature and translation, where would you recommend they start?
I think starting with Shona Davies or Patrick Ford's translations of the Mabinogion is a great place to start. Those are the canonical works of Middle English literature, and they have useful introductions to the language in the preface. So that would be a fun place to start. There are also a few studies by Helen Fulton. Her book, Medieval Celtic Literature and Society, is very useful. And also her and Garrett Evans' Cambridge History of Welsh Literature gives, as a Cambridge history does, very brief, quick, light speed studies of different areas of Welsh literature. And for something more comprehensive, I would recommend The Guide to Welsh Literature by Jarman and Hughes, which is quite old at this point, not super easy to find. But I really like it because it covers non-literary genres of Middle Welsh writing, which I think is important because there's such a focus on the prose literature that's original to Wales that sometimes the other genres like history or law or medicine get overlooked. So The Guide to Welsh Literature, although it's quite old, is very useful because it gives you really detailed surveys of what is out there. And then for someone who wants to study Middle Welsh, there are a lot of online resources. And excitingly, there are two textbooks for introductions to Middle Welsh. One is out this year by Brent Miles, and one is soon to be out by Joshua Byron Smith. And so there's some new opportunities for studying Middle Welsh beyond the traditional introduction to the language, which is where you translate one of the four branches alongside Evan's grammar, which is the way that we've all learned Middle Welsh, but it sometimes is quite challenging. So hopefully there are, going forward this year, fewer barriers to introduction to the language.
Well, thanks for those recommendations. And thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. Georgia, it's been a real delight to have you.
Thank you for having me.
It's time, unfortunately, for our exploration of multilingual Britain to come to all too early an end. To reiterate, we've had to leave out some languages and have only just scratched the surface of those languages we've gotten to look at. What I want you to take away from this episode is this. Pre-modern Britain was a multilingual place, with several languages all interacting with each other in a dynamic social and linguistic network that, while subject to change over the centuries, persisted throughout and beyond the Middle Ages. If we want to think about the multicultural Middle Ages as a concept, multilingualism is one of the most important things for us to consider. And we need multiple scholars to come together to really understand it. Thanks for listening.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.